I would say that sharing your truth and getting to a point to share your truth is probably the greatest battle of your life, whatever your truth is.
So, Bridget, today we have a super special episode that's going to go a little bit differently than our previous episodes, and that's because this one is about identity. How do you feel about that word, Bridget?
Identity has been a long journey most of my life, certainly my young life. It's always been complicated. I think that identity is complicated for everybody, but it's especially complicated when you're a Black person, a marginalized person, because finding your footing can be really, really hard, and it can be a process.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of times people, as a marginalized person, you know, people think that they have an idea of how your life should go, how it should be, you know, all these stereotypes and stigmas that are forced upon you. And you choose your identities, you know, you define yourself. So that's a process that is a lot different for marginalized people.
Definitely. From a very early age, I knew that I was a queer person. And, you know, all of the messages that I got from TV, from family members, from everybody, was that Black people who were gay or queer or trans or lesbians or whatever, like, we did not exist. And so the message that I, you know, absorbed was, you do not exist. And so I would think, well, I know that I am a Black person, and I know that I have these feelings and all of that. I remember, like, laying awake in bed at night thinking, what does this mean? Like, who am I? And this is going to sound a bit strange, but my parents were really into music, and my dad had this vinyl copy of this Earth, Wind & Fire album, All in All, which is a classic album, so you should definitely listen to it. But if you've ever seen it, it has this amazing cover that has this, I mean, I still see it when I close my eyes. It has this pyramid on the top of this bright blue skyscape and these Egyptian-looking statues. I always kind of walked around feeling like an alien, feeling like I didn't fit in, feeling like, you know, people like me didn't exist. And so I always identified with science fiction, Afrofuturism. But as a kid, I would just stare at that Earth, Wind & Fire cover and, like, run my hands along it and think, what does this mean? Like, is this, I mean, it was like finding an artifact that made me think, I feel like I'm from a different planet. This is also a relic from, you know, Black folks in space. Like, I didn't understand it because I was very young, but that is what I, like, seized onto. And that became a really big part of my identity, was sort of accepting that it was okay if you were an oddball, a weirdo, whatever, that there were other folks like us out there. And thanks to that Earth, Wind & Fire album that I spent many, many, many hours staring at as a child.
I'm here with you on being the oddball weirdo. So, you know, weirdos unite. But it seems like you kind of, there is this feeling of, like, being able to envision something beyond what you are in the present moment or what you are feeling in the present moment. And I feel like that's a thing that can come up a lot in art and music, and something that I really connected to in art and music too. And I think that books were that way for me. Like, I definitely had my nose in a book and was that kid who was up reading under the covers super late at night, staying up just to have my nose in a book. One thing I always say, you know, I loved books, but I also had a specific teacher who just was really serious about getting me to read all the Black books possible. Like, you got to read this, and you got to read this, and you got to read this, which I really look back and appreciate her for. But it's funny because I say all the reading that I did in the dark when I was a child is the reason that I wear glasses now. So, yeah, I think I was also able to see worlds and see experiences and existences beyond where I was at the moment through books.
So I think that we tell ourselves this story that media, TV, movies, books, all of that, they're just these frivolous distractions or just entertainment. But really, they can let you see yourself. And that's so important to our understanding of identity, being able to see yourself, you being able to read books and think, one day I can be a writer, I can be living out the stories that I'm reading in these books. You know, that's so important. And it's especially important for folks who are marginalized. You know, white folks see themselves reflected every day. They are considered to be the archetype, you know, the everyman. And we don't get that same luxury. And so it's so, so important that we're able to see these things, to see ourselves, so that one, we can understand our identity, and two, so we have that license to dream.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the whole white archetype thing, because it's something that I struggled with. You know, my love for reading definitely turned into a love for writing. And then I got to a point where I had to question, like, who are these automatic characters that I thought of in my head? You know, even though I did, you know, read a lot of Black books, I also read a lot of white books with all white characters. And, you know, when I was writing, I would default to that. There would be like this default character, even though I was surrounded by a lot of Black people. And I really had to question why it was that I had, you know, internalized that. So yeah, art's very important and it's very impactful. And you might notice it and you might not. It might be something you see in hindsight, but media does shape a lot of our identity.
Right, but that's the trip of white supremacy, right? That we internalize it, and that we spend a lot of time on this show talking about dismantling white supremacy externally. But we all should also talk about the ways that we internalize it. And, you know, that's the trip of living in a white supremacist society. This shit is tenuous. This shit gets in your bones. It gets inside of you. It gets inside of your head. And to pretend otherwise is just wrong. And so those are the conversations, I think, that are really important and that can be tackled through art, through books, through media, through dance, through culture.
Yeah, I think in thinking about identity, we have to remember that it's okay to constantly evolve. It's okay to change our mindsets. It's okay to learn better. It's okay to change. So now that you've gotten to know a little bit more about Bridget and I, we're going to introduce you to some people who have their own stories and have a lot to say about identity, which is a word that can seem really weighty, but really means a lot of different things to different people. Right, Bridget?
That's true. And because it does, it can be pretty powerful to Black people to speak for ourselves, about ourselves, because we've all got different perspectives in lives and express ourselves in different ways.
Even though we may have certain characteristics we think really define us, like our Blackness, we're more than that. We're complex. I'm Eve Jeffcoat.
And I'm Bridget Todd. You're listening to Afropunk Solution Sessions. Afropunk is a safe place, a blank space to freak out in, to construct a new reality, to live our lives as we see fit while making sense of the world around us. Here at Afropunk, we have the conversations that matter to us, conversations that lead to solutions.
So I've been thinking about those character descriptions at the beginning of plays. The ones that try to sum up a character in a sentence or two, you know, female, Black in her 20s, maybe a few more details. A lot of times people try to define Black people in that super narrow, superficial way, but there are many other layers beneath that surface. So today we're going to break down those complexities by introducing you to a cast of characters, well, real life people who have a lot to say about identity. First up, Momo Pixel, the creative.
I just make it do what it do. Like, I'm a Black girl, and this is how I dress. And it's like, if you don't like it, I don't really care.
Momo describes herself as a professional creative. She's an art director, artist, and musician. When Momo says, "This is how I dress," she means decked out in a bunch of different bright colors. Multicolored braids, cotton candy-colored tutus, her own pixel art come to life. She does her own thing. We talked about her personal expression.
I mean, me, my color, my laugh, everything was in defiance of my childhood. And like, to be honest, me and my Blackness, that was something I had to learn about after college. Like, that's crazy, but like my life, I was dealing with so much shit with my family and my childhood that I wasn't in a space that I'm Black. I was in a space that, oh, I need to make it till the next day. Oh, I need to figure out how I'm going to be able to keep this homework. How am I going to make these grades when I don't have this? How am I going to, like, do this when my dad is doing this to me? Like, me navigating the space now, I mean, I'm just in it. You know what I mean? Like, I just make it do what it do. Like, I'm a Black girl, and this is how I dress. And it's like, if you don't like it, I don't really care. It's hard for me sometimes to navigate it because I'm multiple things. So I don't know if somebody's treating me bad because I'm fat, you know what I mean, or chubby or whatever the fuck you want to call it. I don't know if somebody's treating me bad because I'm a woman. I don't know if somebody's treating me bad because I'm Black. And I don't know if somebody's treating me bad because of the way that I dress. You know what I mean? So it's like, the way that I navigate it is just by not giving a fuck.
Right.
It's like, people didn't like me for just being born. They didn't like the way that I was. I'm like, if people can't like me off default, then of course it's going to be people who don't like me once I come into myself.
She lives in Portland, which, as we know, is super white. She says she literally has to stop people from touching her and that people take pictures of her through her job's windows. But working in a white space can be pretty frustrating at times, Momo says.
It's like a double-edged sword. It's like, yay, I get to, like, put my voice out there and, like, say stuff. But it's like, I don't represent all Black people. Why you coming to me like I represent us all? And then it also feels pressure because sometimes you feel like you're only there because they want a Black voice. You're not there because they see your work. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're there as a check mark. And it's like, regardless of how dope you are, they're only going to put you on projects that have to do with Blackness. Because it's like, bruh, I'm Black and, you know, there is a and in there. Like, I am Black and a gamer and a singer and a this and a that. You know what I mean? Like, and I think sometimes companies just put you in Black. And so that's all you have to offer is Black. And I think there's pressure in that because sometimes I think people don't want to leave those jobs because it is a job. And then sometimes you don't want to let the community down because it's like, fuck, if I don't do it, who the fuck's going to do it? And if they do do it, you know they're going to do it wrong.
But Momo's super comfortable in who she is, her abilities, and her work. The advice she would give to others to get to that point, she says, is to just allow yourself to be free.
Freedom is the best thing about this world. If you yourself can allow yourself to be free, then how are you upset that nobody else is? I even got to say my name in some places. That's not even me toot my own horn. That's me. I can literally just walk a place and people like, oh, that's Momo. You know what I mean? But that's freedom in a sense, right? I don't have to open my mouth. I ain't got to do shit. You already know who I am. You probably going to give me some food or something. And I'm dressed the way that I am. No, I get paid in a sense to dress up in tutus. I'm at work right now in a tutu, a Pokemon hat, and a Pokemon shirt. And I'm getting paid. And you couldn't have told me that at 6 years old, you know what I mean, or at seven, my way of not caring is dressing up as a cat and still me mugging people and not talking to them.
They'd be confused as hell, right? Like, hold on.
Yeah, you know, yeah, like, you know what I mean? That's like, for me, that's like ultimate freedom. Or wearing a ball gown because it's Tuesday. That's how I show that I don't care. Because I'm just doing things that I like to do. And I'm not waiting for a special occasion to do it. So whatever way that it is for you to do that and give yourself that freedom, man, do it. The quicker you do it, the quicker you hold the power. And once you own that, you got it. You can do everything.
Next up, Raquel Willis, the activist.
You know, I'm not going to give some full, like, essay on why I'm a woman. I'm a fucking woman. It is what it is.
Raquel is a writer, a transgender rights activist, and national organizer for the Transgender Law Center. When we spoke with her, she talked about how for some folks, coming to terms with identity can be a very long journey.
I mean, I think in a basic sense, identity is like your sense of self. It's the things that you hold on to. And that doesn't necessarily mean that these are things that define you, that you are at ease with. I think that we're always going to have aspects of identity that we're trying to come to terms with and trying to figure out how to frame it in a way that is accepting even for us as individuals. But then also there are aspects of identity that are just pure celebration. And it can take some time to get there. So like for me, Blackness is pure celebration for me. It is something that is divorced from these ideas that we've been indoctrinated with in a white supremacist society and or kind of global society. But that also took work, right? And I think for a lot of people coming to that place where things like Blackness or trans identity or queerness or womanhood can be so celebration is a struggle for most of us because these are all marginalized identities that we've been told are cumbersome or are a hindrance to us being seen as fully human.
How did you get there? Like, what was that journey?
Well, I think it's a never-ending journey. So I don't want to say I figured it all out because I don't think that that is even possible because I think these identities are so expansive. But it's really been, one, figuring out how to tell myself my story. And that has been through writing, things that I have shared and things I haven't shared yet and things that I may never share. It's been finding community and exploring these things with people who are also struggling, right? Because I think that there's a beauty in this kind of collective experience around our identities. And I think the third thing has been realizing that even the people or the experiences or the systems that have tried to extinguish my fire around those identities have their place in this world for some reason. And coming to terms with that and coming to terms with the fact that I am the person that I am because of those struggles.
But, Raquel says, there are so many people who turn their backs on marginalized folks because of their own expectations around identity.
That's why this work is so important. And why I think that there's a lot that everyone can gain from transgender and gender nonconforming people. I really believe that we are the future. I believe that we give a glimpse of a world where we are not encumbered by other people's expectations for us. And the truth is, honestly, we're not that different from everyone else because everyone is inherently gender nonconforming. This idea of the perfect woman or the perfect man or the perfect feminine person or the perfect masculine person is just that. It's just a concept. It's just an idea. It's just an image. But the reality is we have all had points in our lives where we were told we weren't being the way that we were supposed to be. Whether it's little boys and men told that they can't have an emotional intelligence and cry and have a full range of emotions, things that are aspects of being human. Or whether it's little girls and women who are told that they can't be strong and they can't be leaders and they can't be in charge of their own destiny and have agencies. Those are elements of humanity. And for all of the people in between who fit neither script and were forced to figure out their own path outside of all of that.
And part of figuring out that path means finding our authentic voice. So what do you say if there's a little Raquel that's listening right now? What do you say to that person who, I mean, you put it so beautifully, wanting to share your truth. What do you say to that person who wants to share their truth but feels like they can't?
I would say that sharing your truth and getting to a point to share your truth is probably the greatest battle of your life, whatever your truth is. And so I want to acknowledge that because I think that we don't acknowledge that enough, that yes, it is difficult to live your most authentic life. But I'll also say that there are more people out there rooting for you than you may know, right? And you have to figure out how to find those people, whether it means going to a group that you never would have imagined you would go to or an organization or something like that, or moving to a place you need to spread your wings in a way that you can't in your current environment. Do those things for yourself and don't feel guilty about that. And I'll also say that there is beauty in trying to get the people around you or the people that you've always known to understand your truth, but that can't be your only impetus for this journey, right? Like, those people can't be at the core of you accepting yourself. You have to figure out how to do that on your own terms. You have to be selfish about your livelihood and about your survival.
When we get back from the break, we'll talk to an artist with a very unique voice.
Lonnie Holly, the artist.
I try to tell everybody, if you could spend 7 seconds of meditating, 7 minutes of meditating into a mirror, you'll find that it'll take you to the depths of yourself. You'll see your ancestors develop in your face. You'll get so scared you have to leave the mirror. You understand what I'm saying? But it's something that we just can't play with.
Now, Lonnie seems like the type of person to make lemonade out of lemons.
I am from a large family. My mother had 27 of us. Out of her 32 pregnancies, she gave birth to 27 children. And I'm the seventh of her 27 children. So I was taken away from my mother when I was 1 and a half, and I went through a terrible, terrible ordeal of a life, from almost getting killed to growing a little bit, then almost getting killed a second time, to growing some more and almost being beat to death. All of this is trauma that had been on my brain. So for me to take all of that and bring it to a positive again, to the most positive point that I could say, and that would be, I appreciate you, mother. I'm so thankful that mother gave birth to me, for one thing. Not that mother had to be around and take care of me to the duration of my life, but that she gave birth to me. And then the care of my grandmother taught me how to be considered. Consideration or considerate.
Lonnie's bio says he's, quote, devoted his life to the practice of improvisational creativity, unquote. And that's better than any other way I could have put it. His art definitely reflects his identity.
Then when I heard some words from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he taught me to be the best that I could be, no matter what level of life I'm serving. Mostly everybody called me the trash man, the garbage man, because of the things I loved to work with. So I had to learn that I have to be the best garbage man, the best trash man, or the best junk man, or the best artist, using the materials that I'm using, that I can be. And then I showed my grandmama, which was the woman that dug 3 of the graves for 4 of the little girls that was bombed in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. My grandmama helped dug 3 of their graves. So to do a piece of art honoring her, I took 3 shovels, and I called it 3 Shovels to Bury You With. The instrument is destroyed after the music lives after the instrument is destroyed. I'm the instrument. Sooner or later, I'm going to die. But all that I've leave, I got a book over there on the table called Something to Take My Place. After I'm dead and gone, these things will take my place.
Fanshan Cox DeGiovanni, the performer.
I am a Black and culturally mixed woman searching for racial answers.
I like that. I like that. Do you want to add another one? Because you can be as many things as you want to be. So
can I? Oh,
yeah,
good.
Just go,
okay.
Go for all the I ams.
All right. Okay. I am a playwright. I am a producer. I am a storyteller. I am a truth seeker and a truth teller. I am in constant pursuit of justice.
Fanshan does do a lot of things. She has a one-woman show out now called One Drop of Love. She's the head of strategic outreach for the Pearl Street Films production company, and she's a producer. Oh, and she co-authored the inclusion writer Frances McDormand shouted out at the Oscars earlier this year. But her work in all those spaces touches on issues of representation.
The kind of content that I want to help create at Pearl Street around Black identity is really making sure there are much broader representations of Blackness than we have now. And now, fortunately, we've got lots more, and I think we're all, you know, lots of people are moving in that direction, but I still think we're kind of limited, and a lot of it is essentialist. And that we really need to move into spaces of, for example, Black disabled people, which I think, you know, we do not have. We can't point to that story, knowing that story in kind of a, you know, mainstream way. LGBTQ communities, Afropunk communities, right? People who may have been called nonconformist, but that does not in any way take away their Blackness. I think, to me, in many ways, actually reinforces their Blackness, those characteristics of Blackness that, again, are about resilience and struggle and joy and, you know, and just being, you know, just living to your fullest despite so many forces against that. those are the stories that I want to share. And so, yeah, I'm happy to say that I'm moving in that direction of doing development of those kinds of stories.
But her personal story is one of reckoning with identity, too.
Excuse me. Hi, I am so sorry to interrupt. Hello. Sorry, everyone. Fanchen. Well, I heard you call me white twice now, and I have something to say about that. So, I am Blackfeet Indian and Cherokee and Danish.
For the meaning of the title, One Drop of Love, it's really connected to the importance of understanding our history and the ways that history affects who we are today and our relationships. And so I think many times, and especially for people, so my parents were an interracial couple. My mother is white, she's Danish origin, and also Blackfeet and Cherokee. My father is Jamaican and immigrated to the United States in the 1950s. And so I think people like me who are culturally mixed, coming out of interracial relationships, a lot of times people try to put several different kinds of burdens on us, but one of the biggest ones being, oh, look at that, it's all about love. If we just love each other more, then we can change. And I'm saying with this show, no, that's not the answer. Love comes last. And it comes last in the title very specifically because what we need first is truth and justice. And so the truth of the one drop rule is understanding that slave owners created that rule to enslave the children that they created by raping their slaves. So that's the truth of where this comes from. The justice piece is how do we take that rule and how do Black folks empower ourselves with this understanding of this rule, empower ourselves to say at that time, in that period, that is why that rule was created. We now use it differently. We now use it to unify ourselves and to identify ourselves and to say that we are a part of this tradition of resilience and joy and struggle and survival.
So our ideas of our identity can change over time, but the key is finding joy in our identities, even when you don't fully know them.
I think for Black identity, because so much of our kind of immediate ancestry was stripped of us, that part of the answer can be looking further back and then also really, really kind of like finding more moments of joy. You know, the slave narrative, there is no joy in the slave narrative, but there's joy in Nat Turner and Sojourner Truth. I mean, the fact that we don't have a commercial mainstream movie about Ida B. Wells or Sojourner Truth, what we need to do for ourselves is to really find the things to be joyful about in who we are. So as far back as the 1200s to as contemporary as Sojourner Truth and so many people whose names. I mean, Pose is such a beautiful example. Have you watched Pose at all?
One episode. I haven't. I am planning on catching up very soon.
Okay. Oh my God. I mean, this is the. We both need kind of the heroes, the Ida B. Wells, but we also need just like regular everyday folk that were in this period of time. Those are our heroes, like living their lives in this way, living both through struggle, but also like this show is so full of joy. And that, again, goes back to like broader representations, because if we're just stuck in these like small boxes of what we are, we're limited to that in terms of our identity, but we're so much more, so much more.
Glenn Kyle Jones, The Intellectual.
Identity is everything. If you know who you are, then you spend less time trying to find yourself. That's more time you can focus on your past.
Glenn lives in New Orleans and knows a lot about the historic city. But one thing he's really passionate about is cultural education.
The more you know who you are, the easier you are to identify your past. When you want to get into metaphysical, things happen around us all the time. We get signs all the time. You cannot recognize those signs to be on your path if you don't know what your identity is, period. Identity is everything.
He spends a lot of time making sure people know about Black masking and Indigenous culture in America and how we can help support them and fight exploitation.
Even though being immersed in that, the culture of the Black masking Indians, that history still eluded me. I knew what most tourists know and what many New Orleans know or think they know of it, which is that it's associated with Mardi Gras and that it's something that they do when everybody's getting together to get drunk and, you know, sometimes you got to watch out because things can get violent. And that's pretty much the story. You knew they were beautiful. You knew it was some outstanding pageantry going on and something that was royal. You just didn't know what it was. So being in my family's business and being able to travel and always understanding that there was something extremely different and special about New Orleans, about 3 years ago, a cousin of mine that masked in the culture here asked me to help the community with raising funds for feathers. Now, for a lot of you guys that don't know, the most expensive thing for an Indian to put his suit together will be the cost of the feathers. The feathers can cost anywhere from $350 to $550 per pound. A big chief wears 8 to 10 pounds in his suit alone. So the cost can get extremely high. You're not even talking about the beading, the stones, the sequins, the crowns. You're just scratching the surface. So when I found that out in the process of trying to raise funds to support the feathers or buy the feathers so these Indians can still suit up every year, we found how hard it was to get funds for these guys because it was all allocated to others. So that's when we started the 42 Tribes, which is you can find on blackmasking.org, where we chronicle not the Mardi Gras Indians, but the Black Masking culture. Mardi Gras Indians is the title that was given to this culture in the 1980s when the city of New Orleans got the World's Fair, and they needed a tourism marketing scheme. So they took our culture and called them Mardi Gras Indians and gave it to the entire world and said that this is the only place you can get this.
Glenn is all about unlearning myths about our culture, doing research, and taking action based on that new knowledge.
In that, they have taken our culture, like I said, the United Nations in 1992 recognized the Ouachita Nation Indians of Louisiana and Texas. Well, all of the tribes of Louisiana, from the Chitimacha, the Choctaw, the Choctaw, the Houma Indians, and more, come from the banner of a Ouachita Nation. And in 1992, they were recognized as the oldest indigenous nation or people culture to North America. So with that said, we understand that this culture, this practice of Black masking, comes from our indigenous lineage and ancestors that were born and raised here on this land. Now, we are changing the narrative from Mardi Gras Indian to Black masking Indian because that is what our identity is.
When it comes to identity, he really stresses the importance of knowing our truths. And he does. He's serious about education. He says anyone can fact check him if we need to, and even contacts me after we speak to make sure I bring up the penalties of the Code Noir, one of which is cutting an ear off, that were applied to people of color practicing anything other than Christianity.
I want people to not take the story that they've been given since kindergarten about who they are and what they are by someone that is not connected to who they are or what they are by blood, and do research and decide and find who you really are. And when you do, stop doing everything that you're doing and become that.
You have to be willing to let go of your default mind that tells you that European ideals are inherently right, he says.
In order for you to break that, in order for you to see things differently, you have to be willing to say, hey, I don't know anything. I really don't know anything but what someone else has told me. And that should be scary. then you should go and find what works for you, what works in your spirit when you read it, what speaks to you when you search, and what finds you as you search.
And when you find those truths about your identity, you'll also find strength and inspiration.
We are stronger than you guys think. We're way larger than you think. We are way smarter than you think. I ask that people make the connection that knowing yourself, knowing who we are as a people, the word I want to use is engulfing yourself in your culture, is going to be your saving grace in these perilous times. We ask that everybody find culture, find your culture, invest in your culture, mentally, educationally, spiritually.
More Afropunk Solution Sessions after this quick break.
Nicole Kelly, the artsy writer.
I think it's accurate to say that I'm experienced at camouflage. White people love me. Evidently, I'm non-threatening, I'm not like other Black people, and I'm supposed to take that as a compliment. When white people say disparaging things about Black people around me, I'm supposed to understand they don't mean me, they mean them. But in graduate school, I am the only Black writer and the white girls are afraid of me and repeatedly ask the men in my ear to ask me why I hate them. At parties, they forget that I'm in the room. They tell stories about the ghetto Black girls at home and shake their asses around and call it twerking. And if they do remember that I'm in the room but have something to say about a Black person, anything, even something neutral, like this one time a third-year fiction writer from Wisconsin asked this first-year poet from Alabama if she knew the work of this famous poet who happened to be Black, and she whispered the word Black, like my existence is a slur.
You just heard an excerpt from Nicole Kelly's performance, White Drag. Nicole is the co-host of a podcast called Bitch Face with Phoebe Unter. She says it's a podcast about their obsessions, which means they often talk about art, identity, and critiques of power. And making fun of cis white dudes is a large part of it too, she says. But what White Drag really brings up is the idea of identity as performance, how Black and white are constructs, but ones with real consequences.
I mean, with White Drag, like, I wanted to write about, like, the ways I kind of, like, modulate my behavior to, like, appease and accommodate whiteness, and how that, and, like, I guess I wanted to write about the performance of that, which led me to remembering that I, like, used to, you know, kind of, like, wear this costume, which I had kind of forgotten about. Even the fact that I used to, like, wear that wig and, like, go to parties, and I was doing a kind of performance way before I ever thought of myself as a performer or even, like, thought about performance art at all as being, like, something I could do. I'm still kind of intrigued by, like, what my motivations were for doing that, because I feel like it was really a very subconscious thing that I was doing.
Aside from how she felt about her intention for that sort of real-world performance, she also questioned how she chose to tell her stories and who she chose to tell them to. She felt this way after she got on stage to perform White Drag.
I had the first time where I was like, oh, like, I actually, like, want to be a lot more judicious about, like, what I say and who I say it for. I wrote it to perform in a venue that I knew would be a mostly white audience. And then a friend of mine who saw me do it there asked me to perform it at her space, which is intentionally for POC. And so I did, and I did it without really thinking about, like, the fact that I had written it for a mostly white audience. The white audience responded kind of in a way that, like, I guess, not that I expected, but I was sort of, like, it was interesting to see how they responded. And, like, again, like, I kind of wrote it to be, like, a critique of whiteness in some ways. And then when I performed it for people of color, like, I think they thought it was really, like, sad and tragic. And I was like, oh, like, I should really be... But it made me feel like, I was like, that's interesting. It just made me feel like I want to be really careful about, like, performing for white people. I really don't want to, like, write about, like, my pain for the benefit of a white audience again. Like, I think that I'm used to doing that for, like, various reasons, and I really don't want to do that anymore.
And often, Nicole used her art to understand her identity.
I mean, I think a lot of my fiction was a lot about identity. A lot of my characters were Black women who were kind of like me, who I guess had a certain, like, level of privilege, and also had a certain, because of those privileges, maybe had experienced a certain level of, like, comfort in white spaces. I guess I wanted to write story, like, narratives about, like, Black women doing things, traveling or just, like, dating, like, doing, like, very everyday things, and having these tools to ostensibly be, like, comfortable, like, in a white world. But then, like, those experiences are constantly, like, subverted by, like, racialized microaggressions. And so a lot of my stories are about sex. It's, like, women just trying to get laid, but, like, it's always fucked up by, like, some white dude, you know, saying something out of pocket to you, like, that kind of thing. I don't know. I was trying to communicate something about those experiences. I was trying to, like, maybe validate them for writers of color and also kind of, like, try to explain them to white readers. I really liked to write about, like, so-called unlikable women, like, women who, like, were not interested in, like, the male gaze. And, like, that was really fun for me. I guess also with my fiction, like, if there was sort of, like, a motivation for what I was writing, it was partly to kind of maybe figure out certain things, you know, to process certain things about myself and my own identity, but also just to write characters that I felt like were, that I like did not encounter in fiction. Like I was like, I don't ever get to read stories about like my particular kind of experience, my particular experience of blackness or my experience of being a person of color, or even like the way that I wanted to like live my life as a woman. Like I didn't really see a lot of examples of that. And so I also wanted to like write the stories I wanted to see in the world, I guess.
But even though she's thought about identity a lot, she feels like she's been the same person all along, a shy weirdo with a kind of punk sensibility.
In the last, like, I don't know, like 5 or 6 years or so, like, I've really have, like, also come into, like, my queer identity in a really big way. So I felt like the biggest change, I guess, but everything else I feel like, I'm like, oh, yeah, like, I've been me, like, I'm still me. You know? Just more me than I was before.
Michaela Angela Davis and Eleni Davis Knight, the dope mother and daughter.
I think our monikers for identity are super different, my mm-hmm. mom and I. We definitely, we've clashed in some ways, privately called each other out, I think, in some ways. How she identifies as Black and how I do are very different.
Michaela Angela Davis is an image activist and writer who's worked in Black spaces like Essence and the Alvin Alley American Dance Theater. She's been steeped in Black art all her life. And so has Eleni, thanks to her upbringing. But she's clear that she's not the same person as her mom. I asked Eleni how their identities are different.
I think hers is a little bit, for lack of a better word, more of a classic approach to Blackness. Like, it's very activism-based. She grew up in D.C., Chocolate City, Black, Black, Black. Like, that is her thing. And Black women and anything that's, like she'll watch a movie that's awful because it was made by a Black woman to, like, support the cause. And I'm like, it's a whack movie, I'm not watching it. Like, sorry, you know? And for me, I don't feel the need to overly state anything. I'm just who I am. I'm also not leading a Black charge. I'm not in a space where that is my job and my passion. My passion is in the beauty industry. And I certainly find spaces within that to have little moments of revolution and make sure that one image gets to one country that it might be it wouldn't have, or make sure that the model featured on the gondola is Black drinking a coconut, true story. But that's kind of where I'm in, and I know that it can seem a lot more frivolous, but I'm sure there's spaces within my work to show Black women in different ways, but it's not the same. My Blackness is just part of who I am. Blackness is also mom's life. It's also her job. It's her platform. It's her career.
But Eleni does think deeply about her heritage.
Mom identifies so strongly with Black culture, and that is her job and her work. That's not my story. And my interest also lies in, like, I sat down with my grandmother maybe a year or two ago, and she kind of told us, like, this crazy story about our lineage, which I think is one of the coolest parts about our family, is how mixed we actually are and what people sacrifice to love each other in the Deep South and all of that. So I'm also proud that we're Irish and German and Syrian and Black and all those other things, crazy native blood too. And of course, yes, I'm Black. That's how I identify. I don't check, like, Irish on the box, although that would be funny. I might do that just to fuck with somebody, like, Irish, actually. But I think for me, it's more understanding those complexities don't necessarily make me feel like I'm not Black, but that we're multifaceted, and there's a reason why my mom is light skin, blonde hair, and green eyes. Like, that comes from somewhere, and that story is just as interesting to me.
And though that's Michaela's lineage, too, she says she's hyper-focused on Blackness, that whiteness is so, quote, brutal and nasty and stupid and destructive, that she's just not interested in it.
One of the things I miss about D.C. was because it was so Black, like, your doctor was Black. The idea of identity, it was so reinforced that you didn't think outside of it until you got outside of it. Except for, you know, I was so light and blonde. And so that was my thing. Like, I felt so Black inside, but I I presented so light and really blonde. And I remember when I first moved to D.C., and I think I was in the second grade or younger, and all these kids were asking me whether I was albino, and I didn't even know what an albino was. I'm like, oh, no. And so that, the idea of being black and light and black and blonde, that was my sort of identity piece, but it wasn't the same as, like, your blackness being interrogated, because it was Chocolate City. And so you felt this, a comfort. And then I went to Duke Ellington School of the Arts. So I was comfortable with black genius.
And our identities are complicated. There is no blueprint for blackness.
In high school, I grappled because I was very popular, but I wasn't popular with like one group. I had like my weird artsy friends. I had my super rich, crazy like gossip girlfriends. And then I had like two hood girls, which you always need. So I had all these different experiences, but I certainly encountered more often than not passive. They didn't know they were being racist shit from white people who were like, who loved me, but they would just say shit like, oh my God, you're like so much like Rihanna. And I'm like, but then unfortunately, the most aggressive stuff that I got was from women of color who were darker and angry and didn't consider me, you know, black enough, which is a story I'm sure we've all heard in some way or another, but I didn't speak black enough, I wasn't dark enough, I liked too much white girl shit, whatever that means. And so unfortunately, I ended up gravitating towards kind of a hodgepodge of people and ultimately never really felt comfortable in any one space. All white people, all black people, all anything for me is a little bit uncomfortable. And I think most of that is because I'm from New York. So even just visually, all of one thing is like, where are we? But also just, you know, it's a weird place to be in when you are complex, both biologically and intellectually, to fit in. And that's why spaces like Afropunk and other kind of cool girl spaces that are based in the black community but aren't specific to the black community can be really dope.
Michaela says even though she's centered in her blackness, she's still considered alternative in her generation.
I also was working with those alternative artists like Seal and Lenny Kravitz and Michelle and Degotello. And so even though those are all black artists, they're still like on the edge black artists, right. You know what I mean? So these thousand streams of blackness, like identifying myself or my work and my life centered in blackness feels very expansive to me because I feel like there's just so much to explore because my education, even though I went to a historically black high school, I then came to a very white university at NYU and then at Stella Adler, very, very white. Like I was the only person of color in my acting conservatory and they didn't even know I was because I was punk looking and I had short blonde finger waves and wore rice powder and red lipstick. Like, why didn't they know I was black? Like, I literally, and I wore a mouse thing too. I felt so black inside. I'm light as fuck. Like, I'm light. And I put on rice powder and shaved my eyebrows and wore red lipstick. Yeah. I was cool, and I wore a Mao Zedong suit every day for 2 weeks, my first 2 weeks of school. And I didn't know why they didn't know I was black. Like.
But even so, we're never allowed to forget our blackness. We can't divorce ourselves from it. Even when people attempt to dilute, spit on, and rip away our identities, they're always part of us.
Also, just I remember Keith Haring and Michael Stewart were both dope artists that were considered street artists at the time, right? They were tagging them. The cops handcuffed and beat Michael Stewart to death. Keith Haring beat. And it was almost like the party where all of us were having fun and we're like free and we're downtown and it's like East Village, Madonna. It was all of a sudden, oh shit, he's black. That's what happened. And so there was part of it, there was a moment in time when I was young, it really wasn't about black. It was about freedom, and we were all in the same space, and Basquiat's at this party, and da, da, da. And then Michael Stewart got murdered. It's almost like a Trayvon thing in the art scene. And we knew he was murdered because he was black, and He literally had handcuffs on his wrists and his ankles, and 11 cops beat him to death. And Keith Haring kept tagging. You know what I mean? Like that, my innocence broke in that moment too. So there's a lot of, you become who you are as a result of your experiences. And so when you have certain kinds of experiences, they get in your DNA, they make you a certain way. And that's why some things that, when things like racism, things like Jim Crow can deform, like I don't know who my grandmother would have been if she didn't see people hanging from trees at 14 and 15 years old. Like, who do you get to be? You know, like, who do these kids get to be who are being ripped away from their children and, I mean, from their parents at the border and scattered all over the country? Like, who do you get to be? So a lot of who we are is how we were raised. And her father and I made very clear decisions about trying to create spaces that felt safe and supported and creative. And so that's the legacy too, right? Like, again, full circle, when you say, oh, I want Black girls to be free, you better be ready for what freedom looks like in different ways, you know? And sometimes you're just like, oh, freedom looks like that? Okay, that's your freedom, you know? And it's challenging.
So mm-hmm. What does your freedom look like to both of you?
Glitter.
Say that one more time.
Glitter. That's it. That's really it.
Freedom looks like glitter.
This is what my freedom looks like.
Like four different Black girls sitting in a room talking about
what their freedom looks like.
So, Bridget, it's obvious these folks couldn't be confined to some tidy explanation of their identities, but I am wondering how you would finish this sentence. So, I am.
I am me. And you?
Let's see. I am amazing.
I love it. It's true.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Find your authentic voice.
What's another solution, Bridget?
Look for joy in your identity.
Any other solutions, Bridget?
Take pride in all your identities.
Is there another solution, Bridget?
Find the beauty in our differences.
Afropunk Solution Sessions is a co-production between Afropunk and How Stuff Works. Your hosts are Bridget Todd and Eves Jeffcoat. Executive co-producers are Julie Douglas, Jocelyn Cooper, and Quan Latif Hill. Dylan Fagan is supervising producer and Kathleen Quillian is audio engineer. Many, many thanks to Casey Pegram and Annie Reese for their production and editorial oversight. And many thanks to our on-the-ground Atlanta crew, Ben Boland, Corey Oliver, and Noel Brown. The Underside of Power is performed by Algiers. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Afropunk.